Welcome to Iron and Ceramite, Librarius Omnis, where we explore the depths of the Black Library.
Hello everyone, and welcome along to another edition of Iron and Ceramite's Librarius Omnis, where we, myself and John, have taken an arguably huge task going through the Black Library, starting with the Horus Heresy. And we're working our way through it. If this is your first episode joining us, by all means, go back and look at all of the others in the series. We've done more than several videos now on each of the books up to this point in the Horus Heresy series. And you join us today as we start looking at the first omnibus or first collection of short stories, Tales of Heresy, which is book...
Book 10.
We've hit double figures. So... nice to get there, and I think it's a nice change of pace. But as I said, before we get into that too much, obviously I'm joined by John.
Hello.
And we'll do what we normally do. We'll go through each of the stories in turn. I think today we'll cover the first one, which is Blood Games. But the good thing about this is that it's a real palate cleanser, because up until now, each of the books has been a very focused story on one particular topic. Now that we've got to this collection of shorter stories, they're a bit more bite-sized. So it allows you to take your time. I dare say we'll still make several videos out of this. So I have no doubt about how we go about these particular stories. We will take our time analysing them. But it does give you a bit of a snippet of each side of what's happening during the heresy. And this is very much, Blood Games itself is one that runs alongside what's happening in the heresy, with the heresy taking place whilst this particular story is happening. But it's kind of like its background text, its flavour. It's one of the, as it said, tales of heresy. It's one of the side stories that you wouldn't read in the main narrative arc of the heresy overall. So really enjoyable. And as I said, really nice to have some stories that are a bit shorter, a bit easier to digest. That's been my take on it so far anyway. John, I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'd agree, definitely. I've read this one, obviously, otherwise we wouldn't be doing this. I've read Wolf at the Door, which comes next. I'd agree with that. Everyone's becoming aware, aren't they? Shit's gone down. And like you say, when we get into this one, we've not seen anything from these guys. We're just going to sort of see quite how far it's progressing and how people are reacting or trying to understand what's going on. It's good. More perspective, and it's going to, they're good. Like from these two, it flushes out a lot more, like widens out the universe, so to speak, because everything's been very, like the first five books were very, this is all happening here, and then everything else were very like they were very solitary stories.
Exactly, yeah, it's all in isolation.
And now it's like, no, here we are, and this is what's going on, and what the hell are we gonna do? And we're gonna get a little bit more crossover and start seeing people as well, I think.
There's a few nice cameos and nods in this particular story as it unfolds. And as you said, it's our first real view of it's our first real view of Terra. Dives into a lot more of what planet Earth is like in the far-flung future. We'll get into it, because there's some nice wacky stuff, and you're like, okay, right, this is how the Earth is now played out. But it's nice to have that context.
So I like this has a very spy thriller feel to it, this one, I thought. So I like it. I think maybe what we should do, because we're going to keep talking about what it is and what we like, I think let's get into the story, and we'll do it as we go along. Otherwise, we'll never start.
I agree. Let's get into it, because we can cover it off as we go then.
at risk of turning Blood Games into another seven parter.
No, we're gonna try and get this done in one hit, which is what I always ambitiously say before we start any of these videos, and they never end up being that way.
No.
But you never know. It could be, I can't remember how many Tales of Heresy there are.
Seven Tales of Heresy.
So it could be seven episodes for seven stories. Fingers crossed. Pray for us, YouTube. Pray for us.
Yeah. Tangents. That's what does us in.
Yes, indeed. So no tangents. Let's go.
Let's go. So Blood Games, written by Dan Abnett. So you know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
And if you've not been paying attention, he kicked us off. Horus Rising and Legion, to name the first two that he's done. And they were obviously two of our favourites, I think. Definitely. Yeah. Legion was a really good one. So let's go. And I like this because not knowing anything about Tales of Heresy or what was going to be in it and not reading any spoilers, I didn't know anything about, I don't know what Blood Games are, and I didn't know who we were following for the first part of this, because when it starts, we don't find out who our character is for a little while. We get to find out straight away we're on Terra, and we find out very quickly that he's taking part in a Blood Game, which started 303 days ago, and now he's returning to his original starting point, which is the top of the world, in the Himalaya mountain range. And in the time since he left, an entire peak of mountain has been leveled by the Imperial Fists. He had planned to re-enter from the south, but in the time that he'd been gone, the security had increased. More guards, more soldiers, more weapon nests and turrets had arrived, and it was almost unrecognizable. There are also now millions of workers camped around the palace, and he watched the workers from a hidden place for 6 days and had to change his plans completely and decided to come in from the north. But he hadn't just been watching the workers. He'd also sort of, from a distance, been admiring the palace. And he sort of thinks it's not the grandest thing from an architectural view, but the concept is actually mind-boggling. It's an entire mountain range, probably like, well, obviously the Himalayas, had been turned from a mountain range into a residence, and now it was being converted from someone's house into a fortress. But he personally feels like too little too late. The missing peak of the mountains had been leveled and had been turned into building materials. So it sort of sets us up for where we are. So he goes in from the north and in a disguise, as we said, like a spy thriller, spends 3 days disguised as a labourer, working alongside some gene stock ogres, lugging material to and fro, and sort of watching how they work so he can blend in.
Yep.
And he notices, like, during the nights, to relax, these ogres use a drug called Kosh. And when it's used, like, their eyes roll back, their veins bulge, and it makes them speak in tongues. And he took good note of the dosage that they take and the effects that a dose would have. While he's been working them, they tolerated his presence with some caution because they did fear that he may be a gene whip in disguise to spy on them. Until one night, he decided to try and buy some kosh from them, and he went off to a secluded area with three of the sellers, and while they were there, they tried to kill him. Unfortunately for them, one of them tried to stab him in the knife, and he managed to grab this guy's wrist and snap his arm, instantly breaking it. Another one tries to punch him in the head, and these ogres are, like, essentially big enough that if he punched me or you, Shane, we'd turn to pink mist.
Would indeed be pulp.
Luckily, well, this guy, the punch didn't connect with him. Instead, the dagger the other guy had used had been turned and prepared to take the punch, splitting this guy's hand up to his forearm. Ow. The ogre tried to back away, and at the moment, we just call him the Caucasian, smashes the dagger into its forehead and kills him. The third ogre grabs him from behind in a tight bear hug, but he shrugs him off like nothing, turns and rams his hand through its chest, ripping his heart out. The first ogre with the manky arm tries to run away, and the Caucasian picks up a small stone and throws it with a flick of his wrist, and it goes through the back of the ogre's head like a bullet. He then spends some time disposing of the bodies and takes the role of Kosh Rezin. And so we still don't quite know, well, we don't know who our character is, but we know that he's probably quite sizable and he's tough because he's obviously killed these ogres very easily, like stepping on a couple of ants.
Yep, absolutely. There is, we know he's well trained. Mm. We know he's yeah, definitely a well trained operative that is out to, not, he's not there to cause trouble, but no. he is very much a professional.
Yeah. Yeah. So still, if you're like me, I was trying to work out who's it going to be. What Imperial Fist could it be? Because we've been watching the Imperial Fist. Is it a Primarch or what sort of a start is it? So we'll obviously find out in a minute. Mm-hmm. While he was still living amongst the workers, he noted that this large gathering of workers, as it would do, had brought along its own problems like lice, vermin, disease, scavengers, and surrounding the camp perimeter was a patrol of thousands of warhounds to keep the rad wolves away. And at night, the sound of the animals tearing at each other broke through the winds, and it was hard to tell which animal he could hear attacking who. He really needed to get into the palace, but what he needed to do most was avoid the biometric scanners. So he hid himself in one of the material payloads, which would be hoisted up into the palace. So he wasn't just going to walk through, with the workers. And he'd been watching enough that he knew all the timings of all the deliveries. So he measured himself out several doses of the Kosh, enough to overdose himself. And as he felt the payload lift up towards the bioscanner, he ate the Kosh and he was dead within 12 seconds. So a good way to avoid a bioscanner, just be dead and you're not going to get found. But luckily he's got a plan. So he actually wakes up not too long after the pallet sets down. He had had his body tested repeatedly his entire life, and he knew what he could and could not take. What he did was take a near lethal dose of the Kosh, enough to fool the bioscanner, and he woke up in a small amount of pain and went through a well-trained purging exercise, and slid out of the covers and groggily blended in with the workers. And then it took him another 3 days to get through just the outer layers of the palace, using a variety of disguises to get where he needed to go. And he had a displacer to disguise his height and build from the others. Some of the buildings he passed through were so enormous that they actually contained their own weather systems. Because, as we know, he might be in a palace, but he is on a mountain range. So he's not just having a small walk through a big palace. He's doing some distance.
Yep.
Even inside buildings, there were clouds floating under painted roofs. And it was said that rain in the Hegemon was supposed to be a good fortune. But as far as he was aware, it hadn't rained for 3 years. He's now closing on his target. And he knew this because now he was able to see Custodes. The two were watching the Southern Circuit. Two more at the James Bailey, three patrolled along the Congressional, and a single, almost invisible one, stood guard in the Koh Kang Oasis as four more prowled the upper platforms of the taxonomic towers. There were none, however, guarding the northern or western limits, their positions giving away the location of his prey. Their positioning, he guessed that the Hall of Leng was his destination. It was his prey's favourite place when he wasn't dwelling in secret toil. He would be in the Great Hall, measuring space and time. Personally, he wasn't keen on the Hall himself. It was said that the past and the present mingled there and had done long before the Hall had been built, or even his prey had been born. And there was a feeling of tangible darkness, as if some ancient god slumbered there. So I don't know. I think I managed to guess who the prey was just off of that. So hopefully everyone else does, because I'm pretty slow on the uptake with some of these. and I still hadn't figured out quite who we was following either. But we'll get there.
Yeah. It all becomes clear.
Yeah. So he approached from the southwest, no longer in disguise. He wore a thin false hood over himself, which caused light to ignore him and bend around him, robbed him of any shadow or colour. He passed it through as if invisible, his weapon ready, his sharpened punch dagger at his side, sharpened and laced with a lethal nematode venom mixed with kosh resin. He believed it would be deadly enough to slay a demigod. He entered the hall, which was dark and silent, illuminated only by faint, distant orange sparks that floated high above. He adjusted to the darkness and saw columns of old statues and astrological devices. He made his way through. He felt a presence nearby. It was distracted and hadn't noticed him. He moved around the column and set his eyes on his prey, who was kneeling on the floor, reading a massive leather-bound codex. He noticed his prey had the beautiful hands of a sculptor or artist. His prey currently had his back to him and was wearing a white hooded cloak, good enough to show the blood. He knew he wouldn't be able to creep up on the prey and only had one chance, so he surged forward, raising the dagger in one arm. But at that point, a shadow came from another way and met him. He was struck off course and could barely see the attacker, but saw the long straight blade of the Spartha coming at him. He backed off as the false-hooded swordman pressed on him. He only had the dagger to defend himself until it was knocked from his grip, so he lunged in and gripped the attacker by the wrist, tripping him and taking his sword. He felt the weight of the weapon as two more attackers came from the shadows. He backed off again, knowing that escape was his only option now. He managed to off-balance both the attackers and made it out to the front lawn, where he was met by five fully armoured custodes, pointing their guardian spears at him. He surrendered. He spent the night and most of the next day in a cell until the door opened and Constantine entered. He was the master of the custodes, dressed in simple robes. He leant against the wall and said, "Trust you, Aemon. Trust you to get closer than anyone else." And now we'll find out who he is. His name is Aemon Tauromachian.
Tauromachian.
Well, that's part of his name.
I was going to say that's what they call him for short.
Yes. Because custodes live unnaturally long lives and collect names. Can you remember his name?
What, his entire name? No. Yeah.
Well, luckily, I wrote most of it down. But before we do that, so obviously the target was the Emperor.
Yep.
And the blood game was kill the Emperor.
So, it's not a tangent. This is not a tangent. No. This is more background lore, what the blood games actually are. So... the blood games are something that the custodes do compete in, and they're run continually. And like as said in this example, Aemon has been out and about for, was it nearly a year?
In this 303 days.
There we go, in this particular blood game. And the objective is that the custodes effectively are testing themselves. They're testing the Imperial Palace for its security, its defences, how well the custodes are actually doing their job. And the objective the objective of the Blood Games is exactly that. It is to assassinate or to, you know, kill the Emperor, effectively. That's not what they're going to do, but they're going to get as close as they possibly can to trying to achieve it, because then they can learn how they can tighten up their defences. And what we know is that this particular custode, Aemon, must be pretty good, because, as I said, to get this close past the custodes and the security that he's got past so far, that's pretty good going, even for a custodes. And that's the significance of the blood games. That's what it is. And obviously, Constantine Baldor, who is we're just introduced to, big character in the lore, of course. Especially around the heresy as well. This is our first proper introduction to him in the book so far. There may have been passing reference to him and stuff like that in some of the others, but this is the first time we actually get more of an in-depth back and forth and narrative about him and his charges, the custodies. So that's what the blood games are. Obviously, if this is the first time you've read about them, it will be new and you'll be like, oh, okay, blood games, all right, whatever. But that's what it actually is. It's testing of self-testing of the custodies' defences.
Yeah. And there's they're constant, aren't they? There's always one going on somewhere. There's always someone out on a different one.
That's exactly it. So, like, this guy has taken, as you said, like, a year and 3 days to get to where he is. There would have been several others that all started at the same time as him.
Yeah.
Some of them would have been captured. Some of them, I don't think there's any more in this particular batch that are still out there. But like 6 months ago, there would have been another load of custodies that have gone and started the blood games.
Yeah.
And they'll still be out and about working out how they're going to find their way into the Imperial Palace and take out the Emperor. And I suppose it's even more important now because of what's happening with the heresy and the background of the heresy. Because, as I said, Dawn is... He's down and he's fortifying Terra. He's fortifying the Imperial Palace. And so it's even more important for them to see, okay, how good are the defences here? Because if they're not good enough, the traitors are going to get in and ruin the Emperor's day.
Yeah, as we touched on very briefly, his name. So a bit more custodes law. So Amon is his first name. And Taramakian isn't his family name.
Yeah.
But it describes the bloodline that provided his gene source. So then they call them elements, their names, rather than names. They have different elements to it. So the next part element of his name is Zyges, and that's the site of his birth. Lepron, the house of his study. Khan Hedrosa is the place that he was tutored in weapon use, and so on and so forth. And now, Leng would now be added to his name in recognition of his achievement in the blood game. Each name would be formally awarded by the masters of the First Circle. They would then have their name engraved inside the chest plate of the golden armor, and it would curve tightly around inside. So, for example, Constantine Valdor, his name is currently 932 elements long.
Yeah.
So he's done a lot. We're not going to go into all of his names, thankfully, because we would be here for 7 episodes.
Oh, that would be it. Yeah, exactly. That would be its own thing. Yeah, we don't need to do that.
No. The two of them, now free from his jail cell, walk to the House of Weapons to collect his gear. And he asks about the progress of the other blood games. And Constantine tells him that Zerin had been apprehended before he even made it into the Imperial territories. Hado was detected in the Pulpan Desert 4 months ago, and Broker had made it into the Hegemon, where he was caught. They had been impressed and not expected him to have been bettered. So Aemon really went above and beyond by getting into the same room as the Emperor.
Yeah. Real achievement in terms of the blood games. That's not a usual thing to happen.
Yeah. And now basically they're going to go and get him kitted back up into his uniform, and then he's going to have to go off and get interviewed, debriefed, and go through very, very fine detail of every movement he made whilst he was away and how he got as far as he did.
Yeah.
But now he's actually quite worried that he may have caused offence. And he said, well, I raised my hand against him. And Valdor reassures him, says, he forgives you. You would not have hurt him. And Aemon says, well, that's because my blow was blocked. And Valdor says, even if it hadn't been, he would have stopped you. And Aemon's like, well, how did he know I was there? So, but Valdor says, oh, I'm not going to tell you. He'd wanted to see how long it would take the others to find you. So not only was it a test for Aemon to get to the Emperor, it was a test for his security to make sure that they could actually protect him. And previously, he thought the blood games weren't necessarily worth the paper they're written on, but now he's done that, it's probably sort of hit home for him. Actually, it's very important because now stuff's going on. We need to make sure that we're doing our job. It's a serious business. And I would like to know the guys who obviously have let him get so far, what the oh, they're going to face sort of repercussions for it because, all right, they stopped him. But, I mean, he did get into striking distance.
Yeah, it's a fair point, right? Like, what happened? I think they'll learn about it, like, and they'll understand what's happened. I think if it's deemed his skill over their incompetence, if that makes sense. If they're found to be incompetent, then they're in bother, right?
Yeah.
The Imperium is not that friendly to incompetence. No. But if it turns out that it's like, no, they weren't incompetent, it was just he was very skilled.
Yeah.
They'll be like, right, then we have to do stuff to make sure that the very skilled, we've got enough backup, like we've got enough process, we've got enough security that the very skilled can't get through.
Suddenly you find yourself wearing Thunder Warrior armor.
Well, that's it. It'll be like, right, yeah, off you pop. You're on latrine detail. That's what will happen to him, or worse. But I think as their custodes, I think they get a bit more leeway than your run of the mill Marine or Imperial Guard might do in that circumstance.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So after that, they finally go back to the House of Weapons, and he's glad to find that his armor still fits him perfectly. And he's sort of watching down in the lower levels, a squad of Imperial Fists are prepping for a long patrol of the Salvan ramparts. Servitors and slaves were ritually plating them and anointing them with oils and whispered blessings. And as we've seen from a very recent video release, that's quick.
No, it really isn't.
No. So he considers them and says, the Astartes are not like custodes. They're more like very distant cousins. The custodes were the product of an older formative process, which has been refined and simplified to produce the Astartes en masse. Mm-hmm. Custodes are larger and more powerful, but only slightly. The differences were in the mind. Astartes needed brotherhood. Custodes were much more solitary, destined to stand alone centuries for years at a time. They didn't require slaves or servants to armour them or care for their belongings. They would do this for themselves. And now talking to Valdor again, he's saying, Dorne is armour in this place for war. And only a custode of the First Circle would be able to talk about a Primarch by a first name basis. Very casual. So Aemon's been away for a while, and he's sort of getting debrief now about what's happened and asking about this heresy and what's going on with Horus. And Valdor says he doesn't currently think that this is anything to do with his pride or resentment that spurred this. I think that he's of an unsound mind, might have gone mad or got sick. Something has definitely happened that can't be explained. And he remarks that the Imperial Fists have done an excellent job at preparing the palace. And this is ultimately going to be the last line of defence. But if it comes to it, then things have gone far too wrong and they may have failed at their duty. But from there, they go to the custode's office of watch, and Aemon is welcomed back by several other custodes. And the office of watch is a bit like a really, really high tech security control room. They're watching things going on all over Terra, looking out for any anti-unity organizations or terror cells, and then sending in troops and assassins to deal accordingly. You've got data streaming in all over the place, and it's getting deciphered and analyzed. And every hour, the top 12 sensitive items are reviewed with intense scrutiny. And Valdor asks the watch officer for the top matter of the hour. And he replies, it is Lord Sikar. And we'll jump back to him shortly, but Aemon later he gets a debrief. He goes to the training hall because he'd been out of his armor for almost a year and without his weapons, so now he needs to spend some well-earned time smashing up the weapon services and get back into practice.
Yeah, again, poor old servitors.
Yeah. And that's it. But maybe some of these servitors were defending the Emperor not too long ago.
I was going to say maybe they didn't do their duty when it came to the Blood Games, and that's it. Then their duty's now changed.
Mm. So he's doing this, and now he's sort of resenting himself at the thought of the upcoming war. He's now feeling some excitement about getting involved. He's spent his whole life preparing and rehearsing, and now the moment to put things into practice is coming up. However, it's against, so basically distant cousins, because he's already said it's not brothers, but it's his family that he's fighting now. But he's itching to get going, because he's, however old he is, he's been training to go to war for a long old time. He's been created for this purpose, but now he has to put this to one side and put his mind to Lord Sakaar. He'd asked for the assignment because he'd felt out of touch and rusty from being away for so long. So Lord Ferrum Sakaar had always been a person of note to the custodes. He was the Lord of High Brazil, and he had been very critical of imperial policies and was a very powerful man. Through his bloodline and marriages, he held a big deal of trade in the sub-American cantons. Only the careful political gamesmanship of Malkador had prevented Sakaar from reaching the Council of Terror. The other issue was that Sakaar was a descendant of the last tyrant of Terror, called Dalmoff Kin. He'd been one of the last to hold out against the Emperor during the Unification Wars, and the Emperor was only tolerating Sakaar to try and heal old wounds left over from those wars. Sakaar was outspoken, but pragmatic enough not to have been charged with treason or placed under house arrest like many other nobles, but he had always been watched with caution. Now he was becoming a very powerful man, and he had big holdings in the mineral mines off-world, and smaller houses have now recently been flocking towards him in support of his political views. And so after his training, Aemon goes up to a private watchroom where a Sister of Silence maintained an aura of absolute discretion, and he laid out all the key intel for review. So it's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? Like, there's security protocols. They have to have a silent sister there, so no one's spying on them, I guess.
Yeah, so there's no psychic shenanigans. That can't happen. So yeah, but the sisters. So it's interesting because the sisters and the custodes are they operate together quite a lot. They're like the talons of the Emperor. So you will always have silent sisters working with the custodes. Just because, as I said, they're synonymous with each other, which often gets overlooked. As I said, we go tabletop. They've addressed that in that the new codex for the custodes includes the Silent Sisters now. So, it's always been something that they do together. And there's never one without the other, if that makes sense.
So I say there's no, psycho custodes then, that's why they've got the sisters.
No, there isn't. So in a, it'll go back to tabletop. Yeah, there's no units that have psychic powers for the custodes, but they take the silent sisters, who don't have powers either, so to speak, but they can deny.
Okay,
so they're your denial.
They're like blanks.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah,
okay, fair enough, that makes sense then. Cool. So still looking at the plans, as well as Terran allies, Sakaar had been sending out coded messages to several lords off-world, a code which the custodes had not yet broken, but it was recognized as one used in the war by anti-Union forces. The main reason for the sudden elevated interest in Sakaar was his comms with elements of the 1102nd and 45th Imperial Fleets, which had recently declared for the War Master, and it was highly suspected that Sakaar was now trading intelligence with heretics. So he'd gained some permission to go to High Brazil on a covert mission, and he's off now. Very quickly, I like that it sort of just jumps and they tell you, right, now he's off. We've done that. We're on route to Brazil, and he's going under the guise of a high negotiator from France, I would imagine.
From France, yeah. That's it.
having to disguise himself with a displacer and travel as would be custom with six servitors with varying jobs, an astropath, a pilot and bodyguard, who in this case was his fellow custodian, Hado, who was also wearing a displacer. As their ship entered High Brazil airspace, they deployed 16,000 vermiculia probes, which would disperse and dig down into the Earth and look to intercept any data coming from Sakaar's operation. Most of these would fail, but anything that worked would feed data back to him and the custodes directly. They were looking for proof of treason and could not openly take action against Sakaar without it. What they were doing was out of their legal jurisdiction, and if they were discovered, there would be an uproar, and unity on the planet was in a delicate state as it was, and this could bring things crashing down. They needed to avoid scandal, which would bring open rebellion, because Horus is problem enough, and he's a long way away, and we don't need it starting early. So, in the meantime, Amon began using the name Elod Gout, and he took meeting after meeting, trying not to get bored. Eventually, he was taken out on a yacht with to meet a guy called Tolum Sakaar, the fourth brother of Lord Sakaar, and assigned as Chief Executive Officer of Trades. Within moments, Amon knew that Poulton was no threat. He was fat and clearly abusing Sabenweed, and not very bright either. However, his companions were much more interesting. He had the usual servitors, but then four house guards in scowled green armor, warriors of High Brazil's military called the Dracos, very skilled soldiers and veterans. And this got me quite excited when I saw this guy accompanying them, a figure in a cold black velvet coat. that's so excited. I can't even think. and jet black body plate was introduced as Ivan Norn. He was from the infamous and almost extinct Lucifer Blacks. Callback to Legion.
Yeah.
Lord Sakaar was so powerful, he had assigned every member of his family with a bodyguard from the elite Lucifers. Amon spoke with Tolum about trades, ice sports, and the upcoming war for some time. Quite quickly, he became aware that Norn was studying him closely and realized it was certain that the Lucifer knew he was wearing a displacer. The Lucifer Blacks, as we know, are famous for their perception and sharp minds, as well as their fighting skill. However, it's too late to disengage now. Amon went through with his meeting, hoping for word to go ahead from the control room. During a break in the meeting, he had looked for an update, but still nothing had happened until a bell sounded in the distance. He assumed the meeting was to resume, but he noted that the atmosphere had shifted and Tolum was talking to associates in very hushed, rushed voices. One of the Dracos informed him that the meeting was to be cut short due to an incident, and Amon asked what kind of incident, and the Draco said an outrage had happened, a breach in data confidence, before catching himself, cutting himself off and apologising that he shouldn't, and saying he shouldn't have said anything. He asked if he would need to return to his ship, and the Lucifer Black stepped in and said that a room had been prepared for your comfort to wait till the breach was resolved. And we always know that a room being prepared for your comfort is not an offer.
No. You know, as I said, you're going to stay at the pleasure of the, what's his name, from High Brazil. That, you know, it's similar to being, you know, staying on Her Majesty's pleasure. You know, you're not going anywhere. They've prepared a room for you. Off you go.
Enjoy. So obviously they're going to, as we know, it's a polite way to keep them under watch. So once they were locked in their room and left alone, he and Hato immediately began a sweep of their room and discovered that the vox had been blocked. And they took hidden equipment from their servitors. Hato hacked into the local intel source and saw that an emergency parliament had been gathered and they were discussing several probes that they had discovered. It would only be a matter of hours before they were tracked back to their ship. Amon warned him that the Lucifer Black already suspected them and they were just searching for the evidence to link them the two together.
Yep.
Hato managed to get some feedback from the other probes, which had managed to penetrate Sakaar's comms archive. The code is still a mystery, but the header codes remain unencrypted, and four messages were confirmed to have been sent to the Vengeful Spirit itself.
Uh-oh.
Dun, dun, dun.
Bad news.
Yeah. Horus's flagship. That gives us just calls, Amon said. We move now. If called for, strike teams from the Imperial Palace could arrive within 25 minutes. But that would be a shooting match, and that would be counterproductive in their eyes. He wanted to capture Sakaar and have a systematic investigation take place. Amon is not a fan of Bolter Pawn.
No. He's very much more, yeah, let's get it done this way rather than a straight-up shooting match, as he says. It's been a while since we've had some Bolter Pawn, but, you know, that's fine. This is, as you said, it's spy thriller intrigue.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. It's still quite blunt spy thriller intrigue, but it's nonetheless a bit more intriguing than a straight-up shootout.
Yeah. It'll do for us, otherwise...
Yeah.
I get confused enough as it is.
It can't be too complicated, yeah.
No. He pulls out a trigger unit from his pocket and pressed it. Two heavy metal caskets burst through the windows, still smoking from impact. They open them, retrieving their golden armour. Very Batman.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Batman...
I'm trying to think when it's placed, when this book's written.
It's Batman or Batman slash Iron Man, because it's kind of like, it's almost, you know, like in that Iron Man 2 where he's got the suitcase.
Yeah.
And it turns into a suit. It's like, you know, suddenly their golden suits are just missiled through the hotel room and then they go. But yeah, when this would have been written like in our time, probably would have been. At some point, well, there would have been a Batman film out, but it probably would have been one of the campy ones. So I don't know whether it's got that much influence.
I'm just having a very quick look. 2009.
Oh, okay. No, maybe it would have been the what's it called, the Nolan trilogy.
Yeah. So I reckon the Arkham games might have even been out then.
This is very...
that definitely happens in the Arkham games where the bat. Batwing drops him off.
This is very, very tangent heavy.
Now. It is, but let's carry on. Anyway, yeah, I think very Batman. So the Draco elite, led by Ibnorm himself, burst into the room 4 minutes later, but found it empty. He inspected the caskets and abandoned displacers and clothes. He walked to the massive hole in the wall and looked out. In the distance, he could see the Parliament building. He activated his grav arrester and jumped out the window. The alarm bells of Parliament were ringing. Thousands of Dracos secured the perimeter, and Amon and Halo landed nearby and deactivated jump packs they had used as they watched the soldiers scrambling around like ants. Then they saw in the distance the Lucifer Black land amongst them and start barking orders to secure the building and find the enemy. They walked out into the open and passed through the milling soldiers, past Ibnorm himself and up the steps of the Parliament building unopposed. They entered the main hall and saw Lord Sakaar hastily signing documents, whilst his own Lucifer Black waited to get him to safety. Amon reminded Hato not to injure Sakaar. They needed him fit for interrogation. But if they had to fight the Lucifer to do it in one stroke, they didn't have time to waste. With that, they threw down their falsehoods, and Amon announced, "Sakaar of High Brazil, you are sanctioned by the Adeptus Custodes as an enemy of terror. Do not resist us." Everybody froze in fear. A scribe ran for the exit, and the Lucifer reached for his weapon. Halo stopped him by pointing his own at him. "One excuse," he barked. This guy, he does like Bolter Pawn. Sakaar rose and tried to show outrage, but he reeked of fear as he stuttered. "I will demand an apology from your master," he began, and Amon cut him off. "He is supposed to be your master too. You will come with us now and answer to a list of issues that brand you as a traitor." Suddenly, several blinding lights went off. Amon initially thought they were grenades, but realised they were lights from teleporter units. Suddenly, there were seven figures in front of them. Six were Adeptus Astartes in full battle armour, instantly recognisable as the Huskals of the Imperial Fists, and in the centre, a much larger figure, Rogal Dorn himself. Amon bowed his head, And Dorne said, "This must stop." "Put up your weapons," he said. The fists raised their weapons smartly to the shoulders, but the custodes kept theirs pointed at Sakaar, seeming confused. And Aemon explained, "Sakaar is a traitor. He's passing information to Horus Lupercal and conspiring against the Emperor. He will come with us." And Dorne just looks at him and said, "Or?" So at this point, I was like, what?
Yeah, what is going on here?
And I think Aemon is like, what?
Yeah.
So he repeats himself. And Dorne turned to his Huskarl and commended the custode's loyalty, acknowledging that they would fight 6 Astartes and a Primarch just to complete a mission. "I'm half tempted to let you try and go through me. I would, of course, hurt you both." "You would try," said Hado, before adding quickly, "our lord." So they're casual, but they're not that casual.
Yeah. Yeah, and, he catches himself as like, I probably can't. I could say that to anyone else, yeah. You know, any captain of the Imperial Fists, but I probably can't say it to the Primarch.
Even when they think they might have to fight him, they're still my lord.
yeah, that's it. Yeah, we're going to have a dust up.
Yeah, but you might kill me, but if I'm polite, it won't hurt.
Yeah.
So Dorne, like, he says, enough of this. And his commander steps forward and explains that Sakaar has been passing information to Horus. Yes, we know he's a spy, but he is our spy. And Dorne says, mind blown. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was going to say, originally I started typing things here to talk about, but we'll get to this. So Dorne explains, "I'm fortifying the planet, but this means more than just walls and guns. It means intelligence. Sakaar is actually as loyal as any, but Horus suspects otherwise. And due to the great work and effort he's put in over the years, Sakaar has been making Horus believe he had our allies on Terra that would rise up and join him when he arrives. Now he may be compromised, and we'll have to employ new spies." Aemon understood and said, "We guard the Emperor just as you do. Would it not make sense to tell us before we came here?" And Dorne sighs and said nothing. And Hado asked if Dorne knew what a blood game is. And Dorne did and said he'd studied the outcomes to help with planning his own defences. And Aemon suggested that they use this mission as a blood game. The lesson, or weakness, being that those who seek to defend Terra actually start working together with shared purpose and shared information.
Yeah, it so, seems so easy, right?
Yeah. "My lord, you're a dick," essentially.
Yeah. This is your fault, not ours. But yeah.
It's like, how... Because this bit's not... How far had they got before Dorne realize what was going on? And had this got as far as him, or when the alarm went off and someone went, "Fuck, there's custodians here," did someone ring Dorne and be like, "Can you come sort this out?"
I don't think they've rung Dorne, as it were. I don't think they've gotten the bat phone to him.
Yeah.
More Batman analogy. I think what's happened is that obviously as he's their spy, he's being monitored as well by the Imperial Fists separately. And I think as soon as the, what's it called? The little bugs. As soon as they were detected, the Imperial Fists were notified. And they were like, right, what is going on down there?
Yeah.
And then that's like, right, okay, now we've got to teleport in. So I think that's probably what happened. Or that's my read on it.
Yeah, it probably makes sense.
You know, and then that's when it's like, yes, he is, you know, they explain it all and the penny drops and you're like, yes, he's a spy. Of course he's a spy, but he's our spy. And then you're like, oh boys, you've really fucked this now, haven't you?
Yeah. And I really, really have as well. Like, if he's like the main guy that was supposed to be Horus's mate, like, it's not something they can easily just step someone up in his place, especially like if there are people in this palace that,
That's the thing. There will be. So they will know now that, like, Horus, or, you know, word will get to Horus that actually Sakaar is, you know, he's not the spy that he thinks he is. So that will be that. Like, it will be, you know, he's entirely ruined in that regard.
And it's not like they can just sit someone in his place, because it's not, it'd be too obvious, right? Oh yeah, we got this guy. I knew he was a traitor all along. Don't worry, Horus, I'll take over, because it'll be very obvious.
Yeah, it will be. That's what's so ruinous for it, and why you can sense like Dawn's frustration. Because it is, as I said, there isn't a straight swap. You can't just suddenly be like, right, and now, you know, from you got High Brazil, Low Germany.
Yeah.
You can't just suddenly be like, right, and this guy is also a spy.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't work like that. So it will mean lots of planning has gone. They'll have got good stuff from it. Like they still will have got some benefit from it, but it means they can't continue using that avenue. Yeah. So it's like, right, we're going to have to go a different way now. We're going to have to find, you know, a new double agent and try and regain Horace's trust and feed him more information and so on and so forth. And as you said, there are going to be actual traitors knocking around doing this anyway.
Yeah.
So it's, it's definitely a challenge for them.
Bad. Just when you thought it was over, we're going to jump forward and back very, very briefly. The Icebreaker was speeding away from the landing quay. The assassin hadn't even untied its moorings. He had shot the two docksmen and jumped in, slamming on the throttle. Amon came out in time to seize one of the other mooring lines and was dragged violently behind the Raker. He smashed across the ice towards other recreational vehicles and ice skaters, and Amon was being dragged at such a speed he could feel his armour beginning to buckle. He let go of the line and dug his feet into the ice, just as another explosion went off behind him in the Parliament House. Halo called him over on the box and confirmed that Dawn had left before the first bomb went off and was safe, but Lord Sakaar was dead, as well as other members of his Parliament. He offered to try and catch up and help Amon, but he told him that there wasn't any time. He was still trying to make sense of what happened. Sakaar had been killed by his own Lucifer Black, supposedly. He'd been introduced to him by Ibn Orm, but now it appeared that Horus also had spies working for him, and the Lucifer may have either been replaced or may have never been the man his comrades thought he was. Mm. Amon was annoyed. They had revealed their hand right in front of a spy of Horus, who was there to monitor his allies and punish any betrayal. The concussion bomb had done just that, liquefying Sakaar and sending the two custodes flying through a wall. Amon had got up as quickly as the assassin fled, surprised that he had fled, really, because an assassin's mission usually ended in execution or suicide, but never escape. He leapt up and came down on top of the Raker. The assassin fired up, hitting him in the shoulder, sending him a spray of blood. Amon returned the favour and punched the assassin in the head, pulping the skull within the helmet.
There we go. Bit of pulp.
realising now why the assassin had fled, there was another bomb attached to the Raker and it was heading towards Higher Brazil's reactors. The destination would take the continent out of play and be beyond repair, given Horus a huge advantage. Amon tore out his trigger unit, adjusted the destination and threw it in the cockpit before leaping clear. He fell down and hit the ice violently, spinning for over 40 metres. Up above him, the Raker reappeared and erupted in a ball of flame. The shockwave hit him and sent him flying again. He had driven off this wolf, but more were gathering in the dark, ready to attack. The end.
There you go.
One part, you'll be pleased.
Yeah, no, we did it. Like that. But I suppose this is the nice part about the short stories, right? That, you know, for us, like we can do them in one hit, which is nice. Yeah. But for the reader, you know, they're short enough that they give you a flavour of what's going on around the galaxy, around Terra, around like the entire Imperium. Yeah. During this turbulent period. Mm. So yeah, that's why I really enjoyed getting to this stage. I think book 10 was probably the right time for it as well.
Yeah, especially after Mechanicum.
Yeah, exactly that. And I know there are other short story books coming up, but again, there'll be like another 10 on before we get there. But yeah, really good story. As I said, it's interesting to see like the machinations of how things are working, with how the blood games work, how Dawn's working with the custodes, who, you know, are there they're already there to protect the Emperor, but now Dorne's doubling down on that.
Yeah.
But actually, they haven't worked together yet. So it's quite interesting in regard to how this is playing out.
But that's it, isn't it? It's like the defense of the Emperor from the Custodes almost failed in the first Blood Game. And then, like you said, we'll use this as a Blood Game because the lesson learned is that we're all a bunch of idiots who don't trust each other.
Yes, we need to talk to each other a bit more. Yeah. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to defend the Emperor when if Horus does show up. And we know he does, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. But no, I mean, story-wise, I don't think you can fault that. That was really good. It was it was a weird start at first. I was like, what on earth is going on? And then, obviously, you get that nice reveal after he gets into the palace. And you're like, oh, that was good. And then it's just sort of, it's a nice short story. Doesn't mess about. Like, there's no winding bits of lore or backstory we have to get to. No repeating these two cousins that are really competitive over and over again.
God, we keep bashing on the Dark Angels, don't we?
I'm only joking. It wasn't that bad. So it isn't, like you've said a few times, a palate cleanser. Yes. I think we needed it. It was good. I liked it, and I look forward to doing Wolf at the Door, and I look forward to reading the next five after that, because
it's good. Every one of them's good. I think every story is really enjoyable in this one. Like as I said, you've just finished Wolf at the Door. I'm going to re-listen to it, which I'm looking forward to, because again, it's a really good story.
Yeah.
And again, it's just more of the flavour of what's happening in and around the universe. I won't talk about it too much, but obviously it's interesting because you get a more of an understanding about, you know, how the reunification or the unification of the galaxy is going, and just how futile it can be. But I won't get into that now, because as I said, that will come when we do Wolf at the Door.
Yeah,
it's a good start. It's a good intro. Yeah. As I said, for the first time you come across the Custodes in any detail, it's quite nice to sort of understand what they're about. So it's good. Very good book.
Really good. A good introduction as well. Easy introduction to something that we haven't covered yet.
Indeed.
I think, unless you've got any other points, I think that's us for today.
I think it is. Yeah. I think that's it.
Hmm. Cool. Well, I'll let you do the usual.
I will do the outro. So, thank you for listening along and watching along, depending on where you do it. But if you want to find us, you can find us on Instagram. Just search Iron and Ceramite, and you can use the hashtag Iron and Ceramite as well, and we'll feature you in our Instagram stories. Likewise, we're on Facebook, also on Twitter, YouTube, if you're watching along here. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other podcast services. And again, search Iron and Ceramite if you're listening along. We do have a Twitch account, but there's not much going on there at the moment. I'm sure there will do at some point, but we do have it just in case. Obviously, we have a Patreon. Again, we haven't really done much with it, but if you do support us there, obviously all that money goes back into the channel. And helps buy things like, a new set of headphones for me so my mic doesn't keep bumping against my jacket. Likewise, we are affiliated with Element Games. They always have great deals on all your hobby supplies, both Games Workshop and beyond. And if you use our little link, and use that addition in the link, we get a kickback, which again goes into the channel. If you're following us on Instagram, you'll see that, you know, occasionally we do some giveaways. There's one that we've recently done.
It'll be happening right now.
I was going to say, at time of, it will be happening. And then likewise, we've also used it to get ourselves the new Tempest of War deck, which will then feature on the channel, either in a battle report or just a review of it, like you've seen a lot of other content creators. But again, all of that money goes back into the channel and helps us create content for you guys. And then combat cards. Obviously, you can join the clan if you're into playing combat cards. Yeah, have a go. See where you can get on our leaderboard. But that's it. As I said, anywhere that you can think we'll be, we probably will be. You just search Iron and Ceramite and you can find us.
Cool. So let us know what you thought of this story, our review of the story, and your favourite Tale of Heresy. And we will see you for Wolf at the Door.
As always, we would like to thank you for listening to our Iron and Ceramite podcast. If you liked us, then you can also find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and any other good podcast services. Just remember, in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war.